This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the governor and the legislature don't see eye to eye on the state of the state. Governor Cooper makes the annual speech and calls for a repeal of HB 2, while Senate leader Phil Berger blames him for the law's continued existence. Meanwhile, the clock ticks on an NCAA decision on removing future playoff games from the state because of the law. The General Assembly gets to work on creating penalties for sanctuary cities and caps on income tax, among other things, and NCDOT says more toll roads are in your future. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more, and we're joined again by Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glenn Berkins is here, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Sean Flynn, and we'll post a picture of this shortly, is managing editor for Spectrum News, and he is, as his name would indicate, a news leprechaun.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
He has, what do you call those shoes you're wearing today?
I have leprechaun feet on.
He has leprechaun feet on. They curl up at the toes.
Yeah, why wouldn't they?
Think Yellow Brick Road. All right. And Ann Doss Helms is here, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. She rounds out the panel, and she's also wearing a shade of green. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you very much. So let's begin. North Carolina's Democratic Governor Roy Cooper gave his first State of the State address to the General Assembly this week, and he called for a cooperative atmosphere of working together.
Now, here in Raleigh, partisan battles, power struggles, and lawsuits may grab the headlines, but we have to work together when we can. To look beyond ourselves, to see what's right for our state, regardless of who's in power. That's what the people of North Carolina want us to do, and what common sense demands us to do. So let's get to work.
Nice, reasonable. In fact, he reported that the state of the state is promising, and then came the Republican response from Senate Leader Phil Berger.
Across the state, Republican legislators received hundreds of thousands more votes than their Democratic opponents. Yet Roy Cooper, who squeaked into office by a mere 10,000 votes, has treated his election as a mandate to fight Republicans rather than an opportunity to work together.
So as Betty Davis once said, fasten your seatbelts, we're in for a bumpy ride. So what have we learned here from these two statements?
Well, if you didn't already know that the Democratic governor and the Republican General Assembly are not exactly besties, you now know it. I think the thing that was interesting is when this is every 2 years, the governor of North Carolina gives the State of the State address. And I watched this and I was waiting to see the look on Roy Cooper's face, his body language, his posture, because you could almost imagine him addressing a joint session of the North Carolina House and Senate as being almost, you know, walking into enemy territory. I mean, there are lawsuit after lawsuit. There are laws to, curtail the governor's power and thus the lawsuits. There's the ongoing fight about whether or not it's constitutional to have the Senate confirm Cooper's cabinet appointees. And he walked in and actually was very, very calm. I mean, he really wanted to stress, we can really work together.
Was he politely received when he walked into the chamber?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, even though this only happens every other year, this had all the pomp and circumstance of a State of the Union speech. You know, you have the speaker inviting him in, you have the applause, and, you know, many people standing as he walks through up to the lectern where he then began his address. So yes, I mean, there was none of the, you know, calls out of you lie or anything like that. It was absolutely all of the pomp and circumstance and warm greetings that you would expect.
And he stressed, as I think you mentioned, a shared interest in his speech, but he started by talking about HB 2, and he made it known that he wasn't going to budge on his stand against it. He wants to repeal it, saying that it's time to move on.
The law has damaged our state. The legislature must erase this law from our books. Pass a clean repeal of House Bill 2, and I will sign it the same day. Pass a compromise repeal that works to eliminate discrimination and brings back jobs in sports and entertainment, and I will sign it as long as it truly gets the job done.
So in the GOP response, Phil Berger blamed the governor for the failure of previous repeal attempts. Is it fair to put the blame at the governor's feet? Sean.
Well, that's just the whole strategy right now. Both sides are blaming the other side for not voting for HB 2 repeal. Honestly, if you're not in it on a daily basis, you don't know who's supporting HB 2, who's against it anymore, because everybody...
But it's been in all the papers. We reported it. You reported it. How can people not know?
Well, everybody knows, but I think after a year of this, we've been in HB 2 for a year. We've had so many different compromise bills, suggestions, special sessions, and it never gets done. And both sides continue to blame the other side, saying they're the ones who are not willing to compromise. They're the ones who are not repealing HB 2.
So the statement that Phil Berger made, that the governor is responsible, the governor, did he work actively with other Democrats to not go for the previous repeal attempt because of the referendum that was attached to it?
No, that's the current bill, actually. Okay. That's the compromise bill. What Berger seems to always like to point to is the December special session, where it looked like they actually had a deal to repeal House Bill 2. And Berger and other Republican leaders have consistently said that that deal fell through because of Democratic support. Now, Roy Cooper, I'm sure, was lobbying against certain parts of it. However, one thing that is missing from this conversation is that Senator Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore have supermajorities in their chambers. If they wanted to get the deal done, they could do it without Democratic support. That was never going to be the case. They needed Democratic support to get it. All the way through, because some Republicans are just not going to change course on this. But, you know, whether or not it was really all, Cooper's doing, or whether or not the Speaker and the Senate pro tem just didn't have an accurate whip count of their votes, we really don't know.
Ann?
Well, and there was one more sort of last-ditch effort by the Democrats to slide this through with a banking bill as a repeal. And hoping to beat that deadline for the NCAA to make its decisions about tournaments. And, of course, it failed. And Minority Leader Darren Jackson said, at some point this is going to stop being a policy issue and become a campaign issue. I'm not sure it ever stopped being that. I think that was – we held the panel on HB 2 several months ago, and Richard Vinroot said, once the election gets over, maybe we can find some common ground. But it seems almost as if both sides have decided – this is just a great perpetual campaign issue. We are doing better to stake out our territory and play to our base than to find something that'll work for both sides.
Lundberg.
I think it's going to have to be settled at the polls. I remember when we first started talking about HB 2, I think it was you, Tom, who might have pointed out that the Republicans felt that they had a great campaign issue in this, and apparently they still think they do. But without being too partisan here, it's very disingenuous for the Republican Party to say that HB 2 is still around because of the Democrats. As Tom correctly noted, they have a supermajority. They can get rid of this bill anytime, or they can get rid of this law anytime that they want to.
Well, let's talk about some of the other things that the governor said in his State of the State address, including shared interests that he cited: education, health care, drug abuse, job creation, raising the age of juvenile court proceedings. Are those issues that have common ground? Do Republicans want to do these?
Some. Expanding health coverage, no. And it's not, to be fair, it's not that the Republicans don't want to make sure there's health coverage, at least the state Republicans. It's because what Governor Cooper is, even though he never said the word Medicaid, right, that's what he's talking about. And the Republicans have passed a law signed by then-Governor Pat McCrory that leaves it up to the General Assembly and the General Assembly alone to decide to expand health care. And the reason they did that is because they fear cost overruns. They don't know how much future coverage is going to cost. And in their words, they don't want the state saddled by future debt.
Well, now they really don't know, because in Washington, there are proposals to change the way Medicaid is funded with what's it called, capping and
block grants and
block
caps.
Grants and caps.
Yep.
Yeah, and we don't know whether that's going to go through in D.C. So.
Absolutely.
Everything's up in the air.
This all has to do with the American Health Care Act, the AHCA, which would replace the ACA, which you better know as Obamacare.
Okay. So Trump Care will replace Obamacare, and we don't know what's going to happen with either of those things in the near future.
So to state the really obvious, bipartisanship has more appeal when you need the other side than when you don't. And the Democrats desperately need the Republicans. The Republicans, in most cases, don't need the Democrats. So I think that's why we're seeing with Phil Berger, even if there are areas of common ground, I think there will be raises for teachers. I think there will be some education moves that both sides will be happy with. But he really seems to be staking out that if we do these things, it's not because of Roy Cooper. I mean, he has kind of depicted the Republican Party as victims in all this. In his statement, he was talking about how there have been all these good things, but we haven't gotten any credit for it. But the institutions of the left, the press, the Democratic Party, liberal special interests have ginned up great controversy and false outrage. So, you know, they're just trying to tear us down, and anything that happens good is despite them, not with them.
It's just those headlines, actually, that's doing that.
It's the weekly news roundup on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. And speaking of education, the governor called for money to expand pre-K slots for 4,700 children and an average 10% raise for all teachers, more money for principals and administrators, and scholarships for some teachers who agree to teach in troubled public schools. And he says that would cost $800 million. Any appetite among Republicans for doing any or all of those things?
The teacher raises in some form, and we've talked about that on previous shows, that we would be stunned if there were no raises for teachers. There probably will be significant ones. The details will be where they'll be wrangling over that, you know, at what levels of experience, how much is it tied to performance versus an across the board, and again, who takes credit for it.
The governor also told legislators that we have to work together when we can to look look beyond ourselves to see what's right for our state. That's what the people of North Carolina want us to do and what common sense demands us to do. Is that what citizens want them to do, or do they want their legislators, their elected representatives, to toe the line and dig their heels in and do exactly what they said they would do when they were elected?
We want the answer to be the first part, that common sense is what we expect. Honestly, I think, especially given hyper-partisan districts here in North Carolina alone, where you don't necessarily have any real, I mean, there are only a handful of truly competitive seats for the General Assembly at any given election. And you see this on the national level as well. More and more, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or a Republican district, you see people who think compromise is a dirty word.
Yeah.
You find voters who think, I mean, one of the most deadly words or phrases or labels you can put on a politician these days is flip-flopper. And that gets to that point. Again, we want the answer to be that everyone wants to work for common sense, but until voters actually start putting some kind of muscle behind that, some kind of action behind that, what you really see is encouraging both sides to retreat to their polls as opposed to fighting the middle.
And as we've said many times before, this all goes back to gerrymandering and the way districts are drawn.
I think it goes to voters, too. I mean, I do think we tend to...
But if you draw the voting district so that it's secure, you can do what you want to do, pretty much. And also, it plays to the left and right bases of both parties.
Well, especially the primary system. I mean, we can get into a whole other talk there, but because primaries tend to see your most avid partisans voting as opposed to the great middle.
Right.
But I do think part of this is also the self-selection. I mean, Americans, whether they're in Charlotte or at Hickory or North Carolina or anywhere, we're tending to self-segregate. And we've talked about this a ton on this show, whether it's, you know, by income bracket, by political affiliation. This is a big part of that playing out.
Glenn, we have 30 seconds.
And I think built into that comment is the assumption that there is such a thing as common sense. I don't think anyone is out to hurt the state. It's just, I think we have people who have honest disagreements about what's best for the state and what's not.
Glenn Berkins is editor and publisher of Q City Metro. He's here with Sean Flynn from Spectrum News, Tom Bullock from WFAE News, and Ann Doss Helms from The Observer. And we're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Tom Bullock from our news department, Sean Flynn from Spectrum News. We'll talk about what that's all about in a few minutes here. Glenn Berkins, editor and publisher of Q City Metro, and Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. And you should be following us, because right now on Twitter is a picture of Sean Flynn's leprechaun shod feet. Where'd you buy those shoes, Johnston Murphy?
Some costume shop somewhere out in California.
He looks like a leprechaun. We've been talking about the state of the state address and the reaction to it by the Republicans, and Phil Berger, who is the
Senate Pro Tem.
Senate Pro Tem. Thank you. He delivered the Republican response, and he not only dug in his heels, he kind of attacked all non-Republicans.
They call Republicans ignorant, dishonest, immoral, racist, bigoted, anti-woman, anti-voter, anti-education, even treasonous. They call their neighbors who vote conservatives into office stupid, uninformed, dupes, and deplorables.
Of course, that last one, a reference to Hillary Clinton, I suppose. Mm-hmm. How would you describe that, characterize that? Defiant, angry, or simply calling it as he sees it?
That's a great question. I was really stunned because, in fairness, Senator Berger's response was pre-recorded. So he basically kind of did what he was going to do before he ever heard a word of Roy Cooper's speech. And, you know, Cooper did try to do this kind of we can work together bit. This was it really felt to me as in Senator Berger just lashing out. And I was surprised to see him actually go after non-Republican voters. You know, I expected an attack on Roy Cooper. That's just par for the course for politics. But to actually go after voters who just didn't vote for someone in his party did seem like an escalation of some sort.
But that wasn't entirely a Bergerism, if you will. That's really part of the conservative narrative now. If you go on social media, if you go to certain conservative websites, that in part kind of explains Donald Trump. There are people out there who just feel that the people on the left are condescending, that they don't respect the views of the people on the right, that they believe that they're racist, they're homophobic, they're everything that's bad. So you hear that not just from Berger, but you hear that a lot out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there's probably some truth to that.
And I think you're absolutely right. I think just going on social media, there's anger, so much anger on both sides and people calling each other names, and there's no more. It's just it's disappointing, and it's just hard to watch, hard to listen to. And I don't think this necessarily
helps.
But
there is also sort of an element of depicting people who have traditionally held power as the victims. You know, the Republican Party, people like Phil Berger, are people who have a good deal of power and who have held privilege, but they're kind of depicting themselves as all of these guys are picking on us. You know, we're the common guy, and those snobs are looking down on us.
His speech included a list of achievements. Berger's speech included a list of achievements under Republican leadership in recent years. Among them, he said, an improving economy, an improving education system, an improving business climate. Is any or all of that true?
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely it is. I mean, just on sheer numbers and facts.
Is that a Republican accomplishment?
Yeah. I mean, they were in power when it came in. I think they can fairly claim it as a Republican accomplishment. But it gets complicated. I mean, take something like the economy. How much of that is due to Republican tax cuts versus how much of that is actually due towards the recovery from the Great Recession? It's hard to parse those numbers.
And if the Republicans in North Carolina can take credit for the recovery, then do they give credit to Obama for the national recovery?
Absolutely. and that's the thing. I think part of this comes down to your particular partisan view
perception.
Of things.
Yeah.
But, you know, in reality, another thing, education. And yes, this is complicated. The Republicans can point to the largest teacher pay increases in terms of sheer dollars, but it doesn't compensate for what, you know, the purchasing power or the rate of inflation. So you can, you know, it really does matter on your personal
and
politics. And
correct me if I'm wrong, but the cuts that came to education under Beverly Perdue, the Pat McCrory's predecessor in the governor's mansion, those cuts came as a result of the Great Recession, not because of Democratic wishes, or it wasn't
exactly
on their wish list.
Yeah, there was never
that.
A platform of let's cut education. There were drastic cuts. There were massive teacher layoffs. There was a massive recession going on.
Yeah, and we haven't seen necessarily the teacher numbers rebound as much as to that same kind of level given the population. And in some of those forms, it was actually freezes. Mm-hmm. When you think about like per pupil spending, I believe it was more of a freeze than a sheer cut. And correct me if I'm wrong on that, but it's because the state had to tighten its belt.
Phil Berger also took a page from the, I think you alluded to this a second ago, Glenn. He took a page from the Donald Trump playbook by saying, quote, if anyone but Republicans had accomplished these things, the media would tout North Carolina as a national success story. Instead, the institutions on the left, the press, the Democratic Party, liberal special interests, have ginned up great controversy and false outrage.
Well, I think they keep stepping on their own success, and I will call it success, in that I believe that whoever's in power either gets the credit or the blame.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in power. I think Tom's absolutely right. There are a myriad reasons why the economy here is thriving. But they keep stepping on their own success with things like HB2.
Well, I was going to ask about this, because when the president says things like the media is the enemy of the people, which he has said.
Well, no, Steve Bannon said that.
Well, fine. But
the president tweeted it.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. Yep. Yes. No, you're right. You're right. You're right.
So anyway, when the president says that, the media began to engage in navel gazing. Does he have a point? Should the Republicans be doing some navel gazing?
And by navel gazing,
self-examination.
Of course, they should. They have a supermajority. Absolutely, it's kind of hard to play the victim card when you have practically total power. And until recently, they did have total power.
Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly right. It's hard to say you're getting picked on when you run the joint.
And obviously, no one around this table is unbiased when it comes to the media versus the people in power. But I do think you need to be leery when your government is telling you you should just trust us, you know, when you start trolling the press. Basically, there's a great New Yorker article about how the national administration is just picking fights, just demonizing the press. If you start to believe that I can't trust the independent voices, I can only trust what the people in power tell me, that's a scary road to go down.
And I would like to go back to what the original point was. If you go back 13 months ago, every headline talking about the economy and the business climate in North Carolina was positive. If you just go to any chamber's website in North Carolina, they're talking about Forbes articles and all sorts of other articles, you know, number one business climate, number two greatest place to live, best place to retire. So there were great headlines up until, I would say, March of last year.
Although we are on the list of the happiest cities in the country.
Well,
I would say not just March of last year, but even if you go back to things like the voter ID law and some of those things that were put in place that a judge said were used surgical precision or something like that.
Targeted minorities.
Targeting African Americans. I think if the Republican Party were doing this and really truly focused on building the economy, building schools, I think they would get a lot of credit. But there are a lot of other things that they've done that have hurt them.
So even as Phil Berger was kind of pointing the figure at liberals and the media and the Democratic Party for not giving them credit and for blossoming into false outrage about things, it turns out that he's been changing headlines on his Facebook page. These are his headlines to stories that were published previously by newspapers like the Charlotte Observer and the News and Observer in Raleigh and by WBTV. And the headlines that he's been using on Facebook change the meaning of the story, which violates Facebook policy. What has Phil Berger said about this?
He's called censorship on it. I mean, this is a fascinating story, and the News and Observer just laid it, that article. If those listening now have not read the News and Observer article, it's worth a read. I didn't even know that this tool existed, but for certain categories of Facebook pages, you can actually change the headline of news articles. And the link, to be clear, the link
Why can you do that?
You'd have to ask Facebook.
Well, I can tell you that. I publish content on Facebook all the time, but it's my content. So let's say I want the Facebook headline to be different than the headline that I put on the website. Uh-huh. Or imagine that I had a typo in the headline. What this tool does is it allows me to go in and fix that typo.
Okay. I'm sorry.
And what we're talking about here is, whereas Glenn is making sure that typos are gone, Phil Berger was changing meaning in significant ways. So we would go in, and I'll give you an example because, again, the News and Observer just laid it out. Charlotte Observer headline, sports official says HB2 closing window on hopes of landing NCAA events. Berger's version, Cooper's block of HB2 repeal, unwillingness to compromise is closing window on hopes of landing NCAA events.
And isn't that illustrative of the disconnect between the left and the right in general?
Oh, I think this is actually completely different than that. I think this is, I mean, propaganda is a powerful word, but when you're changing someone else's headline to match a meaning that you want to get out there, you know,
isn't that how they see it? Isn't that how the Republicans or the right see what's
been
going
on with
the left?
Drive people there.
Then don't publish the article.
Yeah.
Where does that stop? Do you go in and change the lead? Do you change the nut graph? Do you insert quotes into the story? Well, you know, you can't do all of that with the Facebook tool, but it's the same principle. If you go in and you change someone's headline and it's content you didn't generate, that's dishonest.
Yeah.
And it also shows that sort of duality about the mainstream media that we see in this, that there is a great desire to appear to be giving the single finger salute to the media while also seeking attention from them. And we talked about trolling the media. Berger's chief of staff, Jim Blaine, responded to all this by saying, how about if you just let us help write the headlines in the first place? We'd be willing to provide your readers and our readers with the accurate and honest headlines they deserve. Well, now, that's not a serious suggestion. That's really saying go jump in the lake.
Because they don't want to troll the media. They want to control the media.
Well, and one thing that's missing here, which I think is important, is how many people actually click through. Changing a headline, the link would still take you to the original unaltered story. Absolutely. But most people on social media don't take the time to go to that click and then read that subsequent headline and then read the content. They think the headline, we've been trained to think a headline is a summary of what you're going to see. So when you change that executive summary, you're changing meaning.
And that's true. We've literally been discussing that in the newsroom, that when you write a social media friendly headline, it can't give away the whole story because there will be people who, if they read that one sentence and think, okay, I know the news, they will not click. So I think Phil Berger's office is very wisely playing on that, oh, look, the News and Observer said this one sentence that we wrote.
Speaking of social media, Democratic state senator and declared candidate for Charlotte Mayor Joel Ford had a little mishap this week on Twitter involving a defecating dog. Why?
Well, for some reason, he thought that this image was an appropriate response to people who had been criticizing him for his stand on LGBT issues. And the explanations were just even more hilarious than the GIF itself, which, if you saw it, it was a little pug standing up against a wall to do his duty.
Yeah.
Get that?
Yeah. It was
so,
just.
So how did violating this dog's bathroom etiquette privacy, how was that a response?
Well, his explanation was that he saw it as a dog who was being creative in an uncomfortable situation. I don't know how that, you know, I think you stink on LGBT issues. Let me show you a dog being creative in an uncomfortable situation. This does not make a lot of sense.
Why has Joel Ford been criticized for being homophobic, among other things? Why?
A big part of it. I'm sorry, Sean, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you go back to just discussions over HB2 and other things, he's definitely been a little bit more moderate, more central, and more looking and talking to the other sides than necessarily the entire Democratic Party.
Well, and he also voted for the magistrate bill.
Absolutely.
Which allowed magistrates to opt out of performing any marriages if they didn't want to perform same-sex marriages.
Right, correct.
Joel is very much a moderate. He's a moderate when it comes to things like that, but he's also a moderate on issues that affect African Americans. And I think he will, during that campaign, he will run into a buzzsaw on certain issues. For example, he supported the bill that allows judges to decide when police video is released. So I think he's going to have to, Ricky Ricardo say he's going to have to do some splaining.
And meanwhile, his campaign manager is saying that they really wish he would not send out these GIFs, and they're thinking of coming up with a selection of approved ones that he can send,
right,
because
so
it's easier to send the image than to type out some words. So they're going to give him some approved images.
He might be in a moderate when it comes to political issues, but an extremist when it comes to GIF use.
It's the Weekly News Roundup on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. You know, given the fact that so many politicians are seeming to get themselves into trouble through the use of Twitter and other
Seriously.
Social media, why don't they just all stop and stay away from it? Seriously.
It actually, okay, so social media is very good for a lot of campaigning. It is exceptionally good use. Hey, it takes you 10 seconds. You get your message out to the masses. They retweet. They favorite. You get a lot of, but it can easily go bad and go wrong fast, as we saw.
Very,
with this,
yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and one thing, we've heard a lot of other politicians say, well, it wasn't me, It was a member of my staff. It was an intern. We gave the keys to the kingdom to the wrong person. I also give Democrat Joel Ford credit because he and his campaign staff came right out and said, no, this was Senator Ford. So I do give them credit for not trying to, you know, pretend it was somebody else and just fess up to the fact that he has a gift problem.
I also give him a little bit of credit for calling the person who called him out on it. And they had a phone conversation, and they're going to have a meeting, and they're going to have a discussion. You know, politicians, they're human. They're going to make mistakes. And it's good, I think, when they make that extra effort to try and talk to the person as opposed to just playing it out on social media.
And I think they're learning what's obvious. Humor does not necessarily play well in a tense situation on social media. I mean, he must have thought the poopy little puppy was just a funny response, you know, kind of off the cuff. But if you are already feeling like this is a major issue to your life and you've gotten a very disrespectful response, it's not funny.
Nothing funny about it. Exactly right. I hate to go back to this, but I'm going to go back to this before we talk about General Assembly happenings. The HB2 issue, the NCAA, plans to announce future tournament sites mid-April. And North Carolina will not, we are assuming, will not be among those sites if HB2 remains on the books. Duke would have played some early round games in this year's tournament in North Carolina.
And Carolina.
Does this mean nothing to legislators? I mean, this in North Carolina, college basketball has traditionally almost been on par with religion. So does this mean nothing to legislators?
At this point, it means less and less. I mean, we did bring this up earlier. When you have any kind of prolonged conflict, the longer it goes on, inertia builds and both sides are less willing to budge. And I think at some point, given the rhetoric that's been out there, that, it doesn't have the impact of when the first bans were announced.
Okay, when we come back, we'll talk about General Assembly happenings this week. We'll talk about some news at Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools and toll roads. More are coming, evidently. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I don't know who that laugh came from, but we're all having a wonderful time laughing at Sean Flynn because of his shoes, which are in celebration of the changeover from Time Warner to Spectrum News. No, it's because of St. Patrick's Day.
Of course, St. Patrick's Day.
Sean Flynn is here. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. A bill was introduced this week in the General Assembly that would make it more difficult for undocumented immigrants to drive unhindered in North Carolina. What would it do?
Well, what it would basically do is if someone was caught driving without a license and they were not a U.S. citizen or have a green card, it would allow the police to take their car, to impound their car, take it, like tow it to a lot. And then if that car is not claimed by someone with a valid driver's license who is also a citizen or a legal resident, it would allow that car to be sold off within or after 90 days. And that does impact quite a few. I mean, I think the National Migration Center estimates there's something like 388,000 illegal immigrants in North Carolina alone.
And 54,000 in Mecklenburg. So I was shocked by those numbers.
So if they were pulled over, they could lose their car.
Correct. And if it's not their car, it would be the car of whoever had given them, you know, the keys. And that's, you know, if you are here in the country illegally, inherently you're going to be driving without a license. So this directly affects the lives of a lot of people. And whether or not you know, wherever you stand on federal immigration policy, you think about these people who are truly, like, possibly taking kids to school, trying to go to the grocery store, whatever it is, this is a significant hit to their ability to just carry out basic daily tasks.
Which I think would be, for the proponents of that bill, that's exactly the intent.
Absolutely.
I do think we have to think long and hard about anything that makes it profitable to pull people over and to confiscate their property, because we have seen that with some of the drug laws, that it becomes extremely profitable for the government to swoop in to throw people in jail with some very long mandatory sentences. Now, if traffic stops can lead to taking a car and being able to sell it, that's something we ought to think about.
Yeah, the House Judiciary Committee voted along party lines to advance a bill that would take away state funds. In fact, it passed the legislature, and Roy Cooper, I understand, just yesterday vetoed House Bill 100. Excuse me, I'm talking about this.
Two different things. Yep.
I'm talking about the local judgeship elections in partisan races. That passed, and that was vetoed by the governor. What does this mean?
Well, first of all,
will it go back and be the veto will be overridden?
It's really possible. I mean, here's the thing, a little bit of backup, just to make sure everybody knows what we're talking about. Yeah. We're not talking about sanctuary cities here. This is House Bill 100. This is something that made Superior Court elections and district court elections for judges partisan affairs again. And it would kind of complete the circle the Republicans started in December in special session to try to make all North Carolina's judges partisan elections again. So it passed both the House and Senate, went to the governor's desk. Roy Cooper, this is his first veto. And, you know, you've got the typical responses from, you know, Phil Berger put out a statement basically saying, you know, people want more information about judges. There's a huge drop off in the people number of people who vote for judges. So this only helps that process. We can debate that if you'd like. But the key thing is, in the Senate, it looks close, actually. I think it will probably be overridden by both the House and Senate. Mm-hmm. But you've got tiny, tiny little bits of wiggle room for the Republicans. And to give you an idea that this is not a universal bill, there was one House Republican who voted against it. And that was Nelson Dollar, who's the main budget writer for the House Republican caucus. He's pretty influential. He was the only Republican who voted against it in the House, but the idea that someone of his stature would vote against this bill means it is not lock stock as quickly as House leadership and Senate leadership would make it seem.
What strikes me is that both sides have a good point, because the governor said that North Carolina wants its judges to be fair and impartial, and partisan politics has no place on the judges' bench. And that's the function of the court, not to be political. And yet, people are political. And so don't you want to know what their fundamental belief is before you put them in a judgeship?
Well, you're missing a point on that,
okay,
which is a point that opponents, including Floyd McKissick, have brought up, which is this also includes a primary run. So this is not just electing judges. They have to go through primaries. And in those primaries, in order to curry favor, the theory goes that you would find judges becoming more activist judges towards the polls of their primary to make sure that they get the most primary support possible.
Glenn.
I think you're absolutely right, Mike. As a voter, I've gone down the ballot and I've gotten to a judge and I didn't have all the information that I needed. And had I seen an R or a D or an I, I might have voted.
Yeah.
I think those designations kind of become shorthand for voters. You might not know everything about it, but if there's an R, you kind of get where that, you know, what that person stands for. If there's a D, but there's the other thing that you talked about as well. Judges should be nonpartisan.
Right, and I know most of you have probably tried to at least cover a judicial race, whether it be local or statewide. And the thing I hear more and more, I'm like, well, how would you know? What are your thoughts on name the issue? And most of the time, what I get back from the candidate is, well, I can't actually talk specifics on that because I might have to rule on that. Mm-hmm. So I find it very challenging to try and tell people what the judicial candidates think because they can't actually talk about
it. Let me go back to that House Judiciary Committee voting along party lines to advance a bill that would take away state funds from local governments that take steps to help undocumented immigrants. This is the so-called Sanctuary City Bill, but we already have a 2015 law on the books prohibiting cities and towns from adopting sanctuary policies. So how would this change things, and why is this necessary in some people's view?
Well, this spells out what would happen if you violate this law that already exists. It puts some teeth into it, essentially. It says, here's some of the things you can do. You can take away state money for roads. You know, this will not just be us wagging the finger at you and saying you shouldn't have done that. This will be something that comes with a penalty.
Okay, let me stick with you for a second, Ann, and talk about schools again, because it seems like every week since you've been on, something new has happened with the CNN. And they are considering now a redo on their 2010 decision to force students from low-income black neighborhoods in West Charlotte into combined elementary and middle schools, and they're saying essentially the parents who were saying, you may regret this, were right. Why?
Well, this was done badly. If you remember this at the time, and we do need to start by noting it was during the recession. The recession was real. The financial pressure was real. But you kind of had this big shuffle of schools, and they said, if we close these three middle schools and put these kids into combined elementary middle schools, this setting will be better for them. There will be smaller groups of adolescents. They'll have continuity from fifth grade to sixth grade to seventh grade. They also closed pre-kindergarten centers in many of the cases. So suddenly you had schools that have a 10-year age range from 4-year-olds to 14-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And they said there was research that said that this was going to be wonderful for everybody. If you even read their own research, it raised a lot of questions about whether it would be good in these high poverty, intensely resegregated settings. So, you know, the years have passed. The schools are still, in most cases, very low performing. They crunched a lot of data, and at every school there are some bad things and some good things, but they're saying it's time to revisit this.
So because they want to redo on this, a do-over essentially, that has implications, you report, for school bonds and student assignment changes.
It does. When you talk about the school bonds, the West Side, the predominantly black community, has traditionally been very strong supporters of school bonds. You have Vilma Leek, county commissioner, who represents that area and has a lot of clout in that area, coming to virtually every school board meeting where comments are allowed and saying, if you don't make this right, you're not going to get our votes. I think there is a recognition that this has split the community. It's also almost like the trailer for the coming attraction of the big student assignment changes. And what they're seeing, not surprisingly, is that anytime you start making changes to schools, even schools where there's been demand for change, it's difficult because they are getting some blowback from a number of these communities. Some of them are fairly unified in saying, don't change this, it worked fairly well. Some of them have been fairly unified in saying, it's not great, we want to go back to something. But in some of them, there's a lot of tension, so they're going to have some tough decisions
ahead. I think the upcoming, and you're right, just the upcoming student assignment plan is just, people are just scared right now. Yes. I keep hearing all sorts of rumors out there. They're taking my kid and they're throwing him from the best middle school to the worst middle school. Now we're going to be bused 30 minutes away. I mean, and CMS, of course, says we haven't drawn anything up yet. And so I think, when that happens, we're going to just see so much outrage by so many people.
Mm-hmm. Let me stick with you, Sean, because we're going to shift gears and go to Huntersville. We've been talking about this red line to Huntersville, this commuter train to Huntersville, for years.
Decades.
And now Katz wants to put that on a fast track, no pun intended, to get it done. But the town of Huntersville has drafted a resolution to reject a $2 million study to build that line in northern Mecklenburg County. They'll be voting on this on Monday. Why?
Okay, so I'll try to do the history really fast. But if you recall, the original plan for the Red Line was to use the Norfolk Southern line and just use a hard rail commuter line. That was two decades ago. And actually, that was supposed to be the second line built after the Blue Line went south. Well, of course, the streetcar is already operational. We're expanding the streetcar.
The blue line
extension should be done sometime in the next year. And still, we don't have a plan for going north. Of course, that's where we had the 77 toll lane controversies. And now the next plan from Katz is to, we can't use the rail line by the railroad. Now we have to create our own line. So they're talking about doing a light rail line. Well, Huntersville, which Mayor John Anarello is Republican up there, he says, you know what, we're tired of these studies. Instead of spending $2 million on a study, just give us that money. We'll make bike lanes. We'll get extra additional bus service. And basically, if you don't study the light rail corridor, you're not going to have the light rail corridor. So that information came out last week, and on Monday, they will actually take a vote on that resolution to send it to the MTC to say, hey, let's slow down or stop the light rail.
And on a clip that I saw on Spectrum News, you have Huntersville Mayor John Anarello talking about how the town and the whole area has spent 20 years designing themselves for the arrival of this light rail line, only to discover that Norfolk Southern never gave permission for that rail line to be used for commuter rail. It took 20 years to find that out?
Not once. And I think Katz was just optimistic that they could share it with them, but never once got a thumbs up. Maybe they spoke to somebody at the railroad who said, maybe we can do it, and they took that as a yes. But we've asked for years, and the railroad's like, no, we're not going to do that.
Meanwhile, Ned Curran, former head of the NCDOT under Pat McCrory, spent time talking with The Observer this week. Although he's a light rail supporter, he also supported I-77 toll lanes, and he says more toll lanes are coming. But didn't we already know that?
Yeah, we did.
Yes.
Yeah, we absolutely did.
Why is this news?
Well, because you can do more of a Q&A with, you know, somebody who is behind it. We right now, there are at least, what, Independence Avenue,
485
and I-77 South. So those are at least three big ticket toll lane projects that we know are in the works or in the planning phases just around Charlotte.
And he said something that might be chilling to cats and their expansion plans, because he says he sees potential disruptors in the form of ride sharing, self-driving vehicles, telecommuting that may negate the need for and or the wisdom of building expensive fixed rail, because in the 20 years that it may take to build the rail, we may have lots of other more flexible options.
Sure. And I'm still waiting for my flying car, though. I mean, that's the thing when it comes to this. Self-driving cars seem to be a reality coming up somewhat quickly. But in reality,
I talked to a self-driving car expert on this program 2 weeks ago. She said flying cars are easy. They're the easy thing to do. The self-driving cars are the hard thing to do.
But that's where the money is coming in. The only reason I know that's a flippant response that I gave, but the point is, you can never, if you think that great technology is always just on the cusp of happening, you never actually capitalize on the things that you need right now. A great example of that is, frankly, a plane that's now going out of service. The 747 was built by Boeing as a stopgap measure because they were positive that supersonic air transport was going to be the wave of the future. It never really took hold, and the 747 became the backbone of long-distance travel.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Well, the Observer reported yesterday, or on Thursday, that the price tag of the Charlotte City Council's Raleigh retreat in January was $42,000. It's the second most expensive retreat in 10 years. The hotel bill alone was $30,000. And dinner at Sullivan's Steakhouse with the Mecklenburg County delegation to the legislature, who are mostly Democrats, was $2,500. Was that money poorly or well spent?
Well, I guess it remains to be seen, but I have a hard time imagining that they're going to suddenly get a lot of love out of Raleigh, given that beating up on Charlotte seems to be the next most popular thing to beating up on the liberal media. So I hope they enjoyed their steaks. I'm not sure they'll get a lot of return for their money.
Speaking of the liberal media, there's some liberal media news this week. Rick Thames is retiring as the editor of the Charlotte Observer. What does this mean for readers? What does this mean for you guys in the newsroom?
Well, this is coming as we are really making a lot of changes to focus on what it takes to survive and thrive in a digital era. So I think that was kind of the timing peg. Nobody was surprised by the transition. When Sherry Chisenhall was hired as managing editor a few months ago, it was with the understanding that she would succeed Rick. But we're really trying to figure out how to pitch stories in a way that they will be well-received by digital readers. So you ought to invite Sherry on the show to talk about it in more detail when you have time.
I think she's been on, but we'll do
that. She has been.
We'll do that. Another media change this week. Time Warner Cable, and by extension, Time Warner Cable News, disappeared from the face of the earth to be replaced by Spectrum and Spectrum News. You have your Spectrum News gear on. Your car's been repainted out in the parking lot, Sean. What will this mean for viewers and subscribers?
Well, the good news for us as a channel is we welcome 7 new counties in the foothills, and so we have a much larger area for Spectrum News. It hasn't changed. Same channel you've known for the last 15 years, 24 hours a day.
But better,
with a new name.
And new shoes.
And new shoes.
Which you can see on Twitter right now. Sean Flynn, managing editor of Spectrum News. Tom Bullock, reporter for WBTV. WFAE News. Glenn Perkins with
Two City
Metro. And Ann Helms with the Charlotte Observer. Thank you.
So close, Mike.